Republican unity appeared increasingly rare. On Saturday, 23rd of January, the Arizona Republican Party voted to censure Cindy McCain, the widow of the former senator and presidential candidate John McCain, and two other prominent party members who have crossed Donald Trump. The actions drew swift praise from the former president, who backed Kelly Ward, the firebrand Arizona State Party chairwoman, who was the architect of the censure and who recently won a narrow re-election. Donald Trump, according to a Washington Post report, called Kelly Ward to offer his complete and total endorsement.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Dark Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing the Maribor Uprisings, directed by Maple Raza and Milton Gillen. And joining me in the studio, we have Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Guardian and The Telegraph. And beside him is Maurice McLeod, who is a social commentator and director of Media Diversified. He is also the vice chair of social policy research organization Race on the Agenda. Now, the Maribor Uprising shows how in the once prosperous industrial city of Maribor, which is Slovenia's second largest city, anger over political corruption turned into a revolt against the mayor, the violent police forces, and a corrupt political elite. This documentary places audiences in the midst of the uprising as crowds surround and ransack the city hall under a hailstorm of tear gas canisters. The Maribor Uprisings raises many questions faced by these events and by the uprisings elsewhere, from the Arab Spring through Paris to Black Lives Matter.
When we watched the images from the protests of the Arab Spring, Greece and Occupy, we were certain that nothing like that could happen here. That is, until they installed the new stationary radar system, which sent speeding tickets right to your home, 70,000 in the first weeks of operation. Then we found out that 90% of the proceeds went to a private contractor, not to our city. Then we learned the mayor had close ties to the private contractor. Then we heard he was running for the National Council, which would give him immunity from prosecution. Then we heard where this was happening, and we went there to stop it. Twice we went into the streets. Twice the police drove us away. Twice the news media, embedded behind police lines, portrayed us all as hooligans and criminals.
We formed a video collective because things looked very different on our side of the police lines. All the footage in this documentary is shot by people like me, people like you. I invite you to join us as we record a new uprising, the third uprising, organized on Facebook and called for tonight. You'll decide how you participate.
Will you stay here and film with the people fighting to hold the square? Or do you go to record those who are seeking safety further to the south?
First of all, welcome to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. So we're in this show, we're reviewing the theatrical version of the documentary. It was initially screened as an interactive film, which gave the audience a chance to make decisions throughout the film. And Mike, if I could start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, I mean, it's interesting, there are two different versions of this film, and I think the version that we saw is an imperfect version in that You know, it has the rough edges that I would associate with activist and collective-derived filmmaking, the rough edges that I think the filmmakers would say authenticizes that the action.
Would you say that by the style of the filmmaking? And
yeah.
That it's done with smartphones? And
exactly, yeah. It's shot on cameras. The fly, and, you know, there's no sort of calculated camera movements, any of the sort of slickness that you would get with more commercially-minded documentary, I think. There's something missing in terms of what we actually get, in terms of what the protesters are protesting against, I think. We get mentioned very early on a certain amount of public money being spent on radar systems. Beyond that, there's a kind of generalized dissatisfaction and grumbling with the administration. So maybe that was all addressed in the interactive version, and we didn't get those. What it has, and what really is its strength, is the sense of absolutely being caught up in the middle of something. And in the middle of something that I think is sort of quite localized. We've seen a lot of films about protest movements in the last few years, things like We Are Many, about the Iraq War, the protests against that, The Square, about the Arab Spring, Maidan, Ukraine. But they're all big, epic movies. This is much more localized. It feels like the kind of protest that you and your friends could organize, or that you and your friends could, you know, rock up to on a Saturday afternoon and participate in. And that's a strength of the film, I think.
So do you think this film serves as a valuable tool for audiences who haven't experienced the protest firsthand?
Yeah, I think so. I think this is one of the reasons why it exists in several forms. It's a very good point of entry, I think, for people who haven't necessarily been on many protests and maybe coming to a protest for the first time, but do feel they have got something to say and something to share. And it shows you all the avenues you can go down in the course of one afternoon or one evening's protest. Mm.
And Marie, sorry, if I could turn to you now. As someone who advocates for racial equality and justice, what was your take on this documentary?
Yeah, I found it interesting. Like you say, that it was very bitty, but that's its nature and that's how it should be. It very much felt like you were in the protest, and I thought we didn't get the full interactive side of things, but that really felt like you were making decisions and you were in amongst it. There were bits, like you say, there were bits missing for me. I would like to have known a little bit more. I think if it were made commercially or whatever, there'd be a bit more about the history, a bit more about how they got into that situation. And yes, you understood that there was corruption and that people were feeling aggrieved, but I thought there could have been a little bit more to show how they ended up in the protest, because one of the big points they made was that people didn't expect the police to behave so violently, that it was a prosperous city and people were kind of used to, since 1991, at the end of the Yugoslavia, they'd had their independence and freedom, they felt very empowered, and suddenly, well, maybe not suddenly, but as the corruption became more and more obvious, the protests grew and ended up pretty violent. I thought that was gathered quite well. So you felt very much like, well, why is this happening? And but maybe with a bit more background from before, you would have got that a bit more. I felt like that was missing a little bit. It's sort of you were plonked right into the middle of it, and it's like, okay, you know,
you're figuring things out for yourself.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
That
totally
was intentional.
Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. Which I guess, if it were a real protest, you know, that's exactly what happens. You're like, well, do I want to go down there?
There's a lot of moral questions, and there's lots to grapple with. And I think perhaps the abstract and philosophical nature of the documentary is a credit to it, and that's the kind of questions it raises. So we really get the sense of desperation and the sense of urgency for their need and want for change in the country. And we also get the sense that nothing has changed for a really long time, and he even suggests that something more radical needs to be done. Mike, I know Maurice mentioned that there isn't a lot of political context, but is there something, there's a need for these people to drive out to the streets?
Yes, I mean, very early on there's a quote where one of the protesters says, you know, we detected this growing chasm between what we want and what the world around us is. And so the entire film becomes a sort of disquisition into, well, how do you fix that gap? How do you bridge that gap? And one of the ways is to look around at the people around you, and they start looking out to one another and making their own images. Now, the protests that we see here come at a very crucial time in Maribor's history. We learn that they've just been named European City of Culture. It's often the case that these big moments tend to sort of focus a lot of energy in this way. I was thinking sort of the run-up to the 2012 Olympics in London. There was a lot of unrest before that. There were protests before the 2016 Olympics in Rio. what we're dealing with here is a contrast between the official version of events, the image that the authorities want to show to the world, and what the people actually on the street are seeing in their day-to-day reality. And one of the ways you bridge that gap is by making your own images. And this is exactly, I think, what this film is doing. It's showing you the images, the reality, as seen by people on the streets who just weren't happy with the image the authorities were projecting outwards to the world.
And Maurice, would you agree with what Mike said? Absolutely. Do you think there's universal aspects to this protest?
I think there are very universal aspects to the protest. I would add to what you're saying in that this was the third protest, and as they said in the trailer, the other two protests had been, you know, filmed by the standard media, and they felt that they weren't representing what was actually going on. So people took control and made their own media. That's great. That's the way forward. And the universality of that is that's what happens now in protest. It's no longer is it, well, let's see what the BBC are saying about, you know, our protest. People get on and do it themselves, and we have the ability now to do that. Maybe not as joined up as a documentary like this, but you know, most protests now, if I were watching a protest, I would go online and I'd watch someone who was there, and I rather than watching the sanitized version, or the version that we know is spun to some extent. So there's a lot in that. There's a lot in let's get our own messages across. Let's film our own stuff. Let's show our own images and tell our own stories. That's universal, and that mm-hmm. certainly came across, I thought.
Well, that's a really good point.
I knew that people went into the streets in Cairo, Athens, Paris and Ferguson for such different reasons. But when I watch their footage, it still reminds me of our experience. I mean, in each city, it was the reaction of the police that turned protests into uprisings.
And Mike, what can you tell us about the way the police are portrayed?
Well, it, for all the sort of rough edges of the film, in many ways, it's a very classical three-act narrative. So the first act is getting people out on the streets. The second act is what then happens once all these people are out on the streets. How do you control that mass of people? And there's, very early on, a fear amongst the protesters that there might be some kind of violent action. I was surprised, actually, that there are one or two clips where you actually see the policemen liaising with the protesters and coming over to the protesters and saying, can you just tone it down a bit? Which, you know, I think if a film was determined to demonise the police force, they wouldn't have those little clips in. But at the same time, we do see a good deal of violent action like that. And as the narrative says, you know, these are the actions that turn a protest into an uprising and have this sort of violent reaction. So I think it achieves a balance. You do get a sense of, you know, the immense amount of fear on both sides, I think, once huge amounts of people take to the streets.
Mm-hmm. And Maurice, but I was getting this impression that the filmmakers had a sense of betrayal and shock by the police force. Mm-hmm. They expected them to be the people's protector, but then they suddenly turned on them and suppressed their voices. What did you make of this?
Yeah, there was a very specific moment, wasn't it, where the narrator said that they came under attack, and it surprised them that they reacted exactly the same as the other protested and started defending themselves. And she talks about love in the barricades. And, you know, you look at the person next to you, if they, you know, you're being pelted with tear gas or whatever, and they pick up a tear gas and throw it back, it's a very natural thing. You feel very, connected to the people next to you, and that really came across. It didn't feel at all, and I don't think it needs to, it didn't feel like an objective view of what was going on. It's like, this is from inside, this is what we're seeing, and that really came across, I felt. But yeah, the police violence, I mean, as a lot of the people interviewed said, that's what really made this into a major protest, because it sounded like people were kind of disgruntled and were cross with the mayor, and then the police reacted in a very strong way, which shocked everyone, which made a counter reaction, which is often the case, isn't it? Look at Catalonia or something, it's often the case that the way the authorities deal with what could be, you know, perfectly reasonable protests ends up sparking something quite bigger.
So we see this in lots of protests, mass protests, Black Lives Matter, the Arab Spring, etc. Mike, did you want to add something?
Well, there's a visual contrast in the film as well, because we're getting lots of different opinions from the protesters. They're a very diverse lot, whereas when we see the police, they're all there dressed alike, they're all in uniform, they're all lined up together, moving forward silently. They become this kind of anonymous threat. Mm. And that's a very sort of effective little tool in the middle, going on in the middle of the film.
It would have been nice, I thought, maybe in the interactive part this happens somewhere. It would have been nice to have seen more from the police, because there was a bit that I saw where a protester said to, trying to converse with the police officer, he says, take your helmet off, come and talk to us.
I'd
like to have seen more of that, because those police surely work and live in the area, I'm always interested in what makes the authority figure, who's still a human, look at someone one of their fellow citizens, and I think, no, you're violent, I'm going to hit you. How can we bridge that gap? I'd like to have seen more from the police side of things.
You mentioned violence. I want to touch on that issue, because I think one of the questions the film raises is this issue of peaceful, artful protest versus violent protest. Where do you weigh in on this debate?
Yeah, it's a constant thing, isn't it, to be honest? Whenever there's, when Ferguson happens, it's like, well, they've got a right to protest, but they haven't got a right to throw anything. And I feel like in my work, I'm constantly defending people's right to protest. And sometimes those protests get carried away because emotions are high and, actions and reactions, like we've just said. Mm-hmm. I can understand. I thought the film did it quite well when it asked the question. It didn't say, violence, of course this should happen. It said, what's the difference between this person and that person? You went that way and they went that way, and they got caught up and threw a tear gas canister back and you didn't. So it tried to make a link, I think, between the protesters, whether they were violent or not violent. I thought that was kind of interesting, quite a brave thing to do for a documentary.
No, very clever.
It opens them up to criticism, I would imagine.
So it's not black and white, it's a complex issue with different layers.
A few days after the third uprising, the one we helped film, Mayor Kangler resigned and a candidate associated with the protests was elected mayor. Across Slovenia, 50 other towns organized uprisings under the slogan Gotovi so, they're finished. The prime minister was swept up in a corruption scandal of his own, his coalition government collapsed, and he was voted out of power. So the initial demands of the uprisings were met, even exceeded.
So after all of that, it seems as though the protests didn't really work. Mike, are you convinced they had an impact?
Well, this is the surprise third act. We're talking about a three-act structure. Generally, these kind of protest movies end with some kind of flag-waving triumph, some sort of great note of hope that the audience can carry away with them. And what happens here is that the protesters meet their aims, but they do so in a way that they don't necessarily expect, and that's the big surprise of the film. So it's not this triumph, it is more of a sort of score draw that sort of they muddle through it. And what you get a sense of is the filmmakers trying to preserve everything that they've learnt in the course of the journey, in the course of the protest, so that future protesters can come out and see the film and have a sense of, well, you don't win every time. Sometimes you win in a way that you don't expect. Sometimes, it's that old thing about life being the thing that happens when you're busy making plans. And this is absolutely reflected in the film.
And Maurice, what do you think of this sort of ending towards of the documentary?
I thought it was successful, even though, not much changed in the lives of the protesters. I mean, that's the thing that leaves you thinking, well, what was it for? But as they said, they achieved all of their goals. Maybe their goals were too short term, changing the mayor and removing the radar cameras. And
some of it seems a bit superficial, some of the changes, like a political reshuffle.
Yeah.
Do you think the film therefore has a wider message about lack of trust in the political establishment?
Oh, certainly. I mean, that was evident that they, as the woman was saying there, they've replaced corrupt leaders with other corrupt leaders. But I felt that the documentary did mention this, that's not the only point of the protest. It's also, it brought people together, it showed that they actually do have some agency and can affect change, even if it's only on a superficial level. There was someone talking about the social, the community type changes that they felt had happened since the protest, that people felt more engaged with each other's lives and more involved. Someone's talking about family history that they started discussing since the protest. So I think that sort of stuff often gets ignored. Did you win or did you not win? You've something just in coming together is important.
It's about, you know, I think we've been schooled to expect instant gratification. And I think one of the things that the film shows is that you can't have an easy win all the time. Sometimes it's a cumulative effect of small victories that build up to something that lasts, that's worthwhile. And I think that's the kind of victory that happens here.
Mm. And what other kind of wider lessons can we learn from this documentary, do you think, on the act of protest? Especially in a time like now, this political climate where we see protests constantly.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure. I'm not sure I watched it thinking, what can I learn about protests? I don't know. I think it asks you questions. I think that's more what the documentary is. It says to you, what do you think about this? What do you think about violence? What do you think about this? What would make you uprise? Do you think this could happen? All those sorts of questions are really pertinent. I watched it and it made me explore thoughts that I was already having about protests and stuff. That's all very good, and it made me think about it from a context which I had no real connection to. I had no real connection to Maribor, or no real knowledge of their protests. So it was good looking at it from, you know, clearing out the emotion that maybe is in some of the protests that I do get involved in, like the Black Lives Matter stuff, clearing away some of that and going, okay, in this instance, this is how it happened. And like she said, I was amazed by how much of it still felt very similar. It felt very familiar, and the reactions and the anger of the crowd, all of that is exactly the same. So I felt it did a very good job at getting that across. I don't feel like it was offering a judgment on protest. I don't feel like that was the point of it. I think it was more, the anatomy of a protest, or, you know, it was more explaining how it developed and ended up.
That's really interesting. So it's open to interpretation, and it's relative to everyone's experience. And Mike, final 30 seconds to you. Would you recommend this documentary?
Certainly. I mean, I would very much now like to go and do the interactive version so I could sort of negotiate my way through the situation as it developed and see how things changed and how it changed my opinion as well. But as a starting point, it's well worth seeing.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this episode. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. Don't forget to leave a comment and your thoughts regarding our show. I've been Camila Shambiati.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
The anniversary of the coronavirus lockdown in the Chinese city of Wuhan on Saturday, 23rd of January, comes as more contagious variants of the coronavirus spread, and efforts to vaccinate people against COVID-19 have been frustrated by disarray and limited supplies of vaccines in some places. The scourge has killed over 2 million people worldwide. We're prepared for you an article written by Brian Melly. The piece is titled, A Year After Wuhan Lockdown, A World Still Deep in Crisis. The article has appeared on the front page of the Associated Press news agency's website, Please stay with us for more of Brian Melly's article. Nearly a year to the day after the Chinese city of Wuhan went into lockdown to contain a virus that had already escaped, U.S. President Joe Biden began putting into effect a new war plan for fighting the outbreak in the United States. Germany topped 50,000 deaths and Britain closed in on 100,000 deaths. The anniversary of the lockdown on Saturday, 23rd of January, comes as more contagious variants of the coronavirus spread, and efforts to vaccinate people against COVID-19 have been frustrated by disarray and limited supplies of vaccine in some places. The scourge has already killed over 2 million people worldwide. In the United States, which has the world's highest death toll at over 410,000, Dr. Anthony Fauci, America's top infectious disease expert, said a lack of candor about the threat under former President Donald Trump probably cost lives. Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, who was sidelined by Donald Trump, is now the chief medical advisor to Joe Biden in an ambitious effort to purportedly conquer the coronavirus. He told CNN that the Trump administration delayed getting sound scientific advice to the country. He said, "When you start talking about things that make no sense medically and no sense scientifically, that clearly is not helpful." Joe Biden signed a series of executive orders on Thursday, 21st of January, to mount a more centralized attack on the coronavirus and has vowed to vaccinate 100 million people in his first 100 days in office, a number some public health experts say is not ambitious enough. Dr. Eric Topol, the head of the Scripps Research Institute, said the United States should aim to vaccinate 2.5 million people a day. Dr. Topol said this was already an emergency, but with more contagious mutations of the virus circulating, it became an emergency to the fourth power. In Britain, where a more transmissible variant of the virus is raging, the death toll hit close to 100,000, the highest in Europe. And the government's chief medical advisor warned that the mutated version of the coronavirus might be deadlier than the original. Patrick Vallance cautioned that more research is needed, but that the evidence suggests that the variant might kill 13 or 14 people out of every 1,000 infected, compared with 10 in 1,000 from the original coronavirus. The consistently high death toll is set to continue as the Office for National Statistics, ONS, revealed that at least 1 in 8 people in England was infected by COVID-19 in December of 2020. Reacting to the latest grim news, Dr. Jenny Harris, who is Deputy Chief Medical Officer for England, suggested that schools might not all reopen at the same time across England as lockdown restrictions are progressively eased. Dr. Jenny Harris told the House of Commons Education Committee on Tuesday, 19th of January, that there is likely to be regional differences in lockdown measures because of lack of inconsistency in infection patterns across the country. Germany extended its lockdown this week until 14th of February amid concern about the mutant coronavirus. Some nations are imposing or considering new travel restrictions for the same reason. France said it will require a negative test from travelers arriving from other European Union countries starting on Saturday, 23rd of January. Canada said it may force visitors to quarantine in a hotel at their own expense upon arrival in the country. Meanwhile, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has warned the country. He said, no one should be taking a vacation abroad right now. If you've still got one planned, cancel it. And don't book a trip for spring break. In another apparent setback, AstraZeneca, a British multinational pharmaceutical and biopharmaceutical company, said it will ship fewer doses of its vaccine than anticipated to the European Union because of supply chain problems. Amid the crisis, Japan is publicly adamant it will hold the postponed Olympics in July. Many experts believe that to pull that off, the nation will have to vaccinate all 127 million Japanese citizens, an effort that may not even begin until late February. The 76-day Wuhan lockdown began a year ago, with a notice sent to people's smartphones at 2 a.m. local time announcing the airport and train and bus stations would shut down at 10 a.m. local time. It eventually was expanded to most of the rest of Hubei province in China, affecting 56 million people. By the time of the lockdown, the virus had spread well beyond China's borders. Wuhan has largely returned to normal. The rollout of shots in the United States has been marked by delays, confusion, and in recent days, complaints of vaccine shortages and inadequate deliveries from the federal government as states ramp up their vaccination drives to include senior citizens as well as teachers, police officers, and various other groups. At the same time, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, reported on Friday, 22nd of January, that nearly 40 million doses of the vaccine have been distributed to the states so far. Just 19 million have been dispensed. Why there are reports of vaccine shortages when so many doses are apparently going unused is not entirely clear. But some vaccination sites are believed to be holding back large quantities of vaccine to make sure that people who got their first shot received the required second shot on schedule a few weeks later. Rate vaccines are being delivered, Alabama officials said it would take 2 years to vaccinate all adults in the state. Alabama has a population of 5 million. Scott Harris, head of the State Department of Public Health in Alabama, said every state had the idea that they were going to get much more vaccine than they ultimately got. He added that there just wasn't enough vaccine to go around. Louisiana said it plans to set up mass vaccination events but can't do so until it receives larger quantities of the vaccine. The state said it has been receiving about 60,000 doses weekly for the last few weeks and was told by federal officials to expect similar allocations for the next month or so. Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards said of the nation's governors, "We all are asking for the exact same thing," he added. "We want more vaccine as soon as we can possibly get it, and we want more lead time to know how many doses we're going to get so that we can do a better job of planning at the state level." In Boston, Massachusetts, nearly 2,000 doses of the vaccine were spoiled at a Veterans Affairs hospital after a contractor accidentally unplugged a freezer. President Joe Biden pledged to set up Federal Emergency Management Agency mass vaccination sites, but some states said they need more doses of the vaccine, not more people or more locations to administer them. Meanwhile, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis said, "We stand ready, willing and able to handle it." He added, "Trying to find Federal Emergency Management Agency setup sites, first of all, that would take like 30 days. It's not necessary in Florida. I would take all that energy and I would put that towards more supply of the vaccine."
On Wednesday, Joe Biden was sworn in as the 46th President of the United States. In his first speech as the U.S. President, he pledged to defeat political extremism and domestic terror.
A rise of political extremism, white supremacy, domestic terrorism that we must confront and we will defeat.
2 days later, Biden ordered the Director of National Intelligence to work with the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security to conduct a comprehensive assessment of the threat from domestic violent extremism.
We're committed to developing policies and strategies based on facts, on objective and rigorous analysis, and on our respect for constitutionally protected free speech and political activities. Our initial work on DVE will broadly fall into three areas. The first is a tasking from President Biden sent to the ODNI today, requesting a comprehensive threat assessment coordinated with the FBI and DHS on domestic violent extremism.
The fast-paced move shows how seriously the new U.S. administration is taking the issue in the aftermath of the January 6th demonstration in which pro-Trump protesters overran the Capitol. The National Intelligence Office was created in 2001 after the September 11 attacks with the goal of combating international terrorism. The involvement of the National Intelligence Office suggests that U.S. authorities are examining how to pivot to a more concerted focus on violence from extremists at home.
People in the U.S. who don't want any more wars, who want money to be used for poverty and homelessness here, those people are now going to be cracked down on with the same policies that they're using to the right-wing extremists. And so I think it took a while for the Biden administration and the Democrats to do this, because I think now they're also going to use it to attack people on the anti-imperialist left, the anti-war left, who don't want any conflict abroad.
What happened to the U.S. Capitol raised questions about whether federal government national security apparatus that for decades has moved aggressively to combat what it called threats from foreign terror groups is adequately equipped to address the threat of domestic terrorism. In U.S. Congress, lawmakers passed a measure requiring intelligence agencies to work on annual reports and strategic assessments of domestic extremism. Many lawmakers blame far-right white supremacist extremism as the most dangerous threat in America. Indeed, they have evidence for their claim. A report conducted by the Center for Strategic and International Studies shows that white supremacists and other far-right groups conducted two-thirds of the terrorist plots and attacks in the U.S. in 2020. It says that anarchists and other like-minded extremists orchestrated 20% of the plots and attacks, although the number of incidents grew from previous years. These groups mostly targeted law enforcement, military, and government facilities and personnel. Last August, Michael German, a former FBI special agent, published a report in which it said white supremacist groups have infiltrated U.S. law enforcement agencies in every region of the country over the last two decades. The report said U.S. law enforcement officials have been tied to racist militant activities in more than a dozen states since the year 2000. It noted that hundreds of police officers have been caught posting racist and bigoted social media content. The report said the main reason U.S. law enforcement have failed to respond to far-right domestic terror threats is that they are involved in such crimes.
From the very beginning, the U.S. state intelligence apparatus, whether it's domestic or foreign, the FBI, the CIA, has been based entirely on the enslavement of African people, of indigenous peoples. And so this notion that Biden and the Democrats are going to crack down on racism within and try to eradicate it is kind of nonsense, because at its very core, the U.S. state has been repressive, has been based on colonialism, slavery.
Concerns about alleged relations between far-right groups and law enforcement in the U.S. have intensified since the start of the protest movement sparked by the police killing of George Floyd in the summertime. But when footage of the protest rally on January 6 showed some police officers were letting protesters enter the building, the authorities started to worry. Investigation shows that there were off-duty officers in the rally and helped others to storm the Capitol building. A poll conducted by Reuters news agency after the insurrection at the Capitol found that 12% of Americans have supported the move. With their enormous power, department-issued weapons, and access to sensitive information, police departments have become attractive recruiting grounds for white supremacist groups. Because of the secretive nature of such groups, it is hard to say how many officers are involved. But since 2009, police officers in dozens of U.S. states have been identified as members of white supremacist groups.
It seems that as Britain left the European Union at the end of last year, the inevitable was going to happen to the British economy as a direct consequence of Brexit, with goods, services and business essentially halting their flow between London and the EU, leaving the British economy gasping for air. Add to this the devastating impact of the COVID-19 virus, which has placed the country into its third lockdown, and there's no doubt that Britain is entering a double-dip recession as COVID-19 cases surge across Britain. With the full impact of Brexit yet to be felt until the end of the first quarter of 2021, the end of 2020 saw the British economy sink by some 2.6%, leaving it easy to predict that things will get a lot worse come spring as Britain sinks further into misery. The cases of COVID-19 in the UK has put the country at the top of the global list when it comes to the worst death rate in the world, with daily death rates in the last few days fluttering around the 2,000 mark, meaning the knock-on effect towards the economy is proving to be equally as fatal. All eyes are now on the UK from Brussels and the rest of Europe to study how they're faring since their departure from the bloc, with many keen to show that by leaving the EU, the future does not look bright, and it's hence aimed at discouraging others to emulate a Brexit of their own. Yet Germany, and in particular Deutsche Bank, have looked at the British economy and concluded that three major factors have contributed to the decline, with two of the main reasons coming from the impact of Brexit rather than that of COVID-19, something that the British will not care to admit. So just how big a fall will the second dip be for Britain? Will it be worse than the first one? And just how long will it take the UK to climb out of a very deep, dark and slippery hole that it's found itself in?
Well, GDP will shrink, likely between 5 and 25%. It depends on how long this lockdown will last, and we have now indications it will be another extension as happened throughout 2020, where initially we were told it was going to be 2 weeks. It turned out to be longer than 2 weeks, so we have to expect most of 21 is going to be a lockdown year, and that will, in that case, of course, we have to look at the bigger figures of GDP contraction, 25 to 30%.
Much like Britain, the EU has felt the impact of the COVID-19 virus. But unlike Britain, the EU has a multitude of industries and services that it can rely on to contribute to the economy, to sway things back into the black in times of crisis. Yet it seems that so heavy has the impact of the third wave of the pandemic been on the EU that the financial commitments made by Brussels have not caught up with the Eurozone, which could see as many as 19 EU states fall into a deeper recession as a result. Already signs are looking bleak for the EU, with the zone seeing its Purchasing Managers Index, or PMI, fall to below 50 points to 49.1, indicating a serious downturn in economic activity, sparked by the stringent lockdowns rolling out again across the EU. But the EU has demonstrated the ability to work together to find solutions. The 2008-2009 global crash was a fine example of such camaraderie. But with things taking an impact on a much larger scale this time round, will coming out of another recession prove to be more demanding this time round?
No, I mean, you know, that's not any more difficult. The problem is, why are we shrinking the economy artificially by shutting down everything and prohibiting business activity? Why are we restricting individual freedoms, and why are we particularly annihilating small and medium-sized enterprises, particularly in service sector, catering, all sorts of face-to-face type of businesses? Is this justified? Where's the cost-benefit analysis? There's never been any. And it doesn't make sense. And of course, the longer you do this, the bigger the contraction.
The future ahead now falls in the hands and arms, it seems, of the people of Europe as various vaccines are deployed to try and stop the virus once and for all. Yet the sheer logistical scale of such an operation, coupled with the already crippling effect on the economy caused by the virus, will mean that many more will suffer before things start to return to any notion of normality for Europe. The end of the Cold War came as a huge relief to the people of the world, who felt that the bipolar world order tension had finally ended, and the world could settle down and live in peace. However, it seems that the Western powers still needed a scapegoat to target, and hence the birth of Islamophobia was commenced, and in the process, the Western media created a new enemy. Yet in 2015, following a spate of numerous events around the world, the leader of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, wrote a letter to the youth of the Western world asking them to ignore the media and reconsider the image of Islam. But it seems that the leader's message of 6 years ago is still very much valid today, as his words are well reflected in the ongoing spreading of fear and the spreading of hatred demonstrated by Western leaders towards Islam and Muslims in general. One only has to look at the far-right ideologies of ex-US President Donald Trump, who during his tenure instigated one of the most controversial and discriminatory laws ever passed when he executed his so-called travel ban on countries with a majority Muslim population. Although it was not Trump who started Islamophobia, he certainly added fuel to the fire through his words and actions.
I'm here to protest Donald Trump's racist, xenophobic immigration order, which is against everything that America is about and against everything I stand for as a human.
Yet the leader of the Islamic Revolution raised a very valid point 6 years ago, and is one that stands true more than ever today as technology advances and has encouraged the youth of the world to break down the barriers fabricated across the globe and use the tools and resources so readily available to educate themselves about the truth, hence exposing the lies and deceit created and encouraged by the likes of Donald Trump et al. When it comes to Islam. With some people being led to believe that Islam is the world enemy, so many fail to see the consequences of Western actions, either directly or indirectly against Islam and Muslims, hence proving that back in 2015, the leader knew that the time had come for enlightenment, and as the message stands as strong as ever today, sadly, the youth of the West are still falling to the influence of negative images, catalyzed and sparked by real extremists around the world, whose sole aim is to create division and tension between mankind. When the French satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo published offensive pictures of the Prophet Muhammad, the Muslim world reacted with anger, stating that the line between freedom of speech and respect for religion and faith had been breached, and saw the resulting attack on the HQ of Charlie Hebdo condemned by the world over, including Muslims, who were horrified by the extremist reaction. Yet the republication of the cartoons, as well as the rise of the far right that stemmed from the events, have seen a huge rise of Islamophobia in France, and is something that's almost been encouraged by French leaders who have failed to condemn the actions taken under the so-called pretext of free speech. Yet it seems that time is not a healer when it comes to such acts, as the rise of Islamophobia begins to gather pace across Europe, in part assisted by the French, exporting their model of Islamophobia across the continent, according to the international head of CAGE, an NGO based in the UK that fights against the discrimination against Muslims. Although the world is currently distracted by events such as the COVID-19 pandemic and various social political events around the world, some have taken a stance against the ongoing phenomenon of Islamophobia, making sure the problem is brought to the attention of the highest authorities. It's hence why some 36 NGOs from across 13 nations around the world have sought intervention by the United Nations to tackle the problem from the top, encouraging world leaders to take a stance against Islamophobia as they would any other form of discrimination or hate. What now remains to be seen is whether a change of president in the US and the lifting of the so-called travel ban will start a new era in the world order and encourage other world leaders and the youth of the West to take a new look at Islam and finally understand that hatred being spread by a small minority should once and forever remain a thing of the past.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump took full advantage of his last hours in office this week to push through a flurry of controversial decisions. One of Trump's final acts was signing a deal to sell state-of-the-art warplanes and drones to the United Arab Emirates. His administration reportedly signed the deal just 1 hour before Trump's tumultuous presidential term was over. Under the agreement, the UAE is expected to receive 50 stealth F-35 warplanes and 18 advanced Reaper drones. The Emiratis have long expressed interest in getting the stealth jets. The UAE was promised a chance to purchase them when it agreed to normalize relations with Israel last August, angering the Palestinians. The arms deal was pushed by the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who is central to the normalization of ties with Israel. The weapons package is considered another part of Trump's notorious dealings with Persian Gulf Arab allies, which have long records of human rights violations. The Emiratis, for instance, have been deeply involved in the devastating Saudi-led war on Yemen, which has triggered the world's worst humanitarian disaster. The UAE has carried out a large number of aerial bombardments in Yemen, where hospitals, schools, weddings, and funerals have been among the targets on the ground. The business-minded former U.S. president boosted weapons transfers to its regional allies despite outcry by human rights advocates. A coalition of human rights organizations recently urged the U.S. to avoid further arms sales to the United Arab Emirates. The rights groups believe more arms for the Emiratis would worsen a set of bloody conflicts in Yemen, Libya, and beyond. Former U.S. President Donald Trump was dismissive of such warnings. The United States itself has been deeply involved in the Yemen war ever since it began in 2015. The U.S. military support for the Saudis and their Emirati allies has included mid-air refueling, providing intelligence and logistics. During his presidential campaign, the new U.S. president signaled a major shift. He has pledged to take a tough line on human rights issues, even when it comes to America's allies. Biden has also hinted at ending weapons transfers and military support to the Saudi-led coalition pounding Yemen. But critics say actions speak louder than words. They say there is no guarantee that Biden will change America's approach as he promised. Saudi and Emirati petrodollars have proved irresistible to many American presidents. Is Joe Biden really willing to put human rights first and change America's stance in the region?
I don't think any American government, any American president is going to step completely away from the petrodollars coming into the American defense industry. However, I think everyone has to realize in Washington and elsewhere is that this war, I hate to keep harping on American national security, but what does it have to do with American national security?
How will he deal with powerful Saudi and Emirati lobbies in Washington? Biden faces tough choices over Yemen and his ties with the regimes of Saudi Arabia and UAE, as he will probably need to make very important decisions soon.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The Orientalist games that are played by America's ruling class must come to an end. It is ultimately an insult that a man who has supported the Iraq War, helped write the infamous crime bill, and was vice president to a man who massacred black and brown people in 7 different countries, is praised as some sort of triumph of progressivism. We now present you an article written by Robert Inlakesh, a journalist, writer and political analyst who has lived and reported in occupied Palestinian West Bank. The piece is titled, Biden Administration Only Has Appearance of Diversity. Please stay with us for more of Robert Inlakesh's article. The recent Western obsession with identity politics has effectively blinded the public from corporate racism in clear sight. U.S. President Joe Biden is no Donald Trump, however, he's also no savior for minority communities. Although on a symbolic level it is great to supposedly see diversity in the government, this is in many ways misses the point if those placed in power do not represent the popular opinions of the communities they come from. The idea of positive discrimination when it comes to electing government officials was supposed to be about ushering in change and a wider representation of minority communities. Elected officials are supposed to, in theory, represent their constituents. Before Americans celebrate the election of someone from a minority community to a position of power in government, they should first investigate the potential for change that they will bring. This is not being cynical, this is just being practical, and is also about not stereotyping someone based upon the color of their skin, their faith or sex, and instead learning about what their track record, their views and policy positions are. To make this easier to understand, nobody will use Condoleezza Rice or Colin Powell as an example of the success of diversification or progression, and with good reason. They were part of an awful war machine that led the U.S. to war and to oppress minorities domestically. Just as if notorious right-wing commentator Candace Owens was elected to a position of power, the left in the United States would barely see cause for celebration. These Orientalist games that are played by America's ruling class must come to an end. It is ultimately an insult that a man who had supported the Iraq War, helped write the infamous crime bill, and was vice president to a man who massacred black and brown people in 7 different countries, is praised as some sort of triumph of progress.